your attention. Call you at work.
I'll leave you with this one. Next week, same place, same time.
Where is my gay pass to your heart, girl? Do I need to write security?
Now, this is Angela Davis. You're listening to CKUT 90.3.
Angela, you're one of a million.
Following is a previously broadcast program.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name is Noah.
Oh, and I am Aaron.
And we're your hosts for today. On today's show, we have a feature piece about the school-to-prison pipeline for Indigenous youth in Canada, looking at how the Canadian school system places many First Nations youth on a trajectory to coming in contact with the criminal legal system and incarceration. This feature is produced by the Prison Radio Show's collective member, Candace Cascanet.
We'll also be airing a poem by federal prisoner Nikki Kish, as well as reading some short news items. We'll start our show today with our monthly segment on birthdays of North American political prisoners that take place in the month of December. This information is obtained from sources in the U.S. Many political prisoners in the U.S. have languished inside for years, often decades. It should be noted that this list is not necessarily complete. We recognize that there are possibly many more political prisoners and prisoners of war. We will be back in a moment.
And now for our monthly section on birthdays of political prisoners and POWs in North America for the month of December. Please note that this list is not necessarily complete, and we recognize that there are many more political prisoners in the U.S. and Canada. Cody Sutherland, born December 19th. Cody is one of the Tinley Park Five. On Saturday, May 19th, 2012, five men were arrested in Tinley Park, a Chicago suburb, for assaulting a member of white supremacist organizers. One of the, quote, victims was arrested on warrants for child pornography. Tsutomu Shirosaki, born December 5th, 1947. Tsutomu Shirosaki is a Japanese national imprisoned in the United States. He has been accused of being a member of Japanese Red Army and participating in several attacks, including a mortar attack against a U.S. embassy. He is currently serving 30 years in a U.S. federal prison. Zola Angona Azania, born December 12th, 1954. Zola Azania is a former Black Panther convicted of a 1981 bank robbery that left a Gary, Indiana cop dead. He was arrested unarmed miles away from the incident. The prosecution intimidated witnesses, suppressed favorable evidence, presented false eyewitnesses and expert testimony, and denied him the right to speak or present motions in his own behalf. Fred Muhammad Burton, born December 15, 1946. Fred Burton is one of the Philly Five, a group of men accused of an alleged attack on police station that left one officer killed. He was sentenced to a life term for murder. Burton has maintained his innocence since his arrest. Private Chelsea E. Manning, born December 17th. Chelsea Manning, a 23-year-old Army intelligence analyst, leaked a video while showing the killing of civilians, including two Reuters journalists, by U.S. Apache helicopter crew in Iraq. She also shared documents known as the Afghan War Diary, the Iraq War Logs, and embarrassing U.S. diplomatic cables with the anti-secrecy website WikiLeaks. Chelsea recently came out publicly as transgender. Connor Stevens, born December 17th. Connor and four others were arrested on May 1st, 2012, and accused of plotting a series of bombings, including of an area bridge. The FBI, working with an informant, created the scheme, produced the explosives, and coerced them into participating. Jerome White Bay, born December 28, 1955. Jerome is an anarchist prison activist who set up the Missouri Prison Labor Union to fight slave labor in prisons.
And the time right now is 5:07 p.m. You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM and online at www.ckut.ca. We're going to be going to, I believe, an ad in just a little bit.
Open Door Books has been sending books to prisons across the U.S. and Canada for over 15 years. We regularly send to immigration detention centers, youth detention centers, as well as federal and provincial prisons throughout Ontario and Quebec.
Open Door Books relies entirely on donations of books provided by the Montreal community. We are especially in need of multilingual dictionaries and language books, how-to manuals, bestsellers, and books on Indigenous issues. You can drop off books at Cooper Concordia at 1500 Demisenev West, at Lacagie-Bie at 5490 Saint-Laurent, or at Head & Hands at 5833 Sherbrooke West.
Open Door Books seeks to support incarcerated communities and work in solidarity with prisoner struggle. For more information, email booksToPrisoners@gmail.com.
And welcome back to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT. We go now to a piece about the school-to-prison pipeline for Indigenous youth in Canada, looking at how the Canadian school system places many First Nations youth on a trajectory to coming in contact with a criminal legal system and incarceration, produced by Prison Radio Collective member Candace Cascanet.
Indigenous people represent only 3% of Canada's overall population, yet make up for 17% of its prison population. As the last residential school was shut down in 1998, penitentiaries have become the new form of containment for Indigenous people in so-called Canada. In a 1988 study prepared for the Canadian Bar Association, Aboriginal rights advocate Michael Jackson stated, "The prison has become, for many young Native people, the contemporary equivalent of what the Indian residential school represented for their parents. Almost 25 years later, young Aboriginal men in Saskatchewan are now more likely to go to prison than to finish high school." That is quoted from the 2012 article written for Briar Patch magazine titled "Pipeline to Prison: How Schools Shape a Future of Incarceration for Indigenous Youth," written by Amanda Gebhard. The term school-to-prison pipeline has been used to describe the links between Euro-Canadian models of education and the over-incarceration of Indigenous youth. The following conversation with Amanda Gebhard, a non-Indigenous researcher based in northern Saskatchewan, and Roland Christian, an Oneida educator at St. Thomas University, makes some links between the Canadian approach to education of Indigenous youth and how this fits into the larger picture of their over-incarceration.
My name is Amanda Gebhard, and I am a PhD candidate at the University of Toronto, and my doctoral research focuses on understanding the connections between education and incarceration for Indigenous youth in the context of Saskatchewan.
My name is Roland Christian. I'm an Oneida from Southern Ontario. Currently, I'm an associate professor in the Native Studies Department at St. Thomas University in Fredericton, New Brunswick. And one of my specializations is Indian residential schools, which I've written a book about. And I have a forthcoming book on indigenous suicide, which should be out and about by the end of this coming year.
And can you explain the term school-to-prison pipeline, what it means and what it is referring to?
Broadly, what this term refers to is the movement of youth, and most often poor and racialized youth, from classrooms and from schools into the legal system. And the pipeline metaphor calls to mind the idea that slipping into the pipeline often means that it is very difficult to get out of the pipeline. And so the school-to-prison pipeline refers to the idea that the first slip into the pipeline that can lead to incarceration can happen at school. So this is a term that has also come to represent, I guess, a body of research that has predominantly been conducted in the United States and in regards to Black and Latino young men. So what researchers have looked at is a number of exclusionary practices of schooling, and they've looked at disciplinary policies such as suspensions and expulsions, zero tolerance policies, special education programs, alternative schools, and the hyper-surveillance of racialized youth. And they looked at how all of these exclusionary schooling practices not only set up students for academic failure, but also how it can set them on a trajectory to incarceration.
And can you talk about the research that you are working on or that you've done in the past in this area?
In my own work, I don't necessarily use the school-to pipeline metaphor, but I do use the nexus metaphor, which refers to the idea that there are the factors that can lead any one person to become incarcerated are multiple and also interlocking. What I'm doing in my own research is I'm looking at the ways in which educators work against the criminalization of Aboriginal youth, and also how educators can expose discourses and ideas that can justify and legitimize the criminalization of youth. I guess I'd like to explain what I mean by complicity. And by that, I mean the ways in which educators can construct the movement of youth to prison as natural and as taken for granted. So in order, what I'm doing to collect my data is that I'm interviewing educators in schools across Saskatchewan, and I have asked them a number of questions on themes related to Indigenous education and incarceration. I'm focusing on how teachers are, again, working to reconstitute who Aboriginal youth are and how teachers are constructing Aboriginal youth as bright learners with bright futures. I'm also looking at how colonial discourses continue to position Aboriginal students as incapable, as non-learners, and then also as in need of interventions.
Can you talk about the links between the undereducation of Indigenous youth, the poor quality that of education that they are receiving, and incarceration rates?
Nowadays, there's a lot of consideration that for one reason or another, schooling's getting better for First Nations people. And I really don't think that's the case. They may have a higher graduation rate. When I was in school, it was something like 99% people dropping out before they got out of high school. And even now, I wouldn't say that people were dropping out, that people were being driven out for one reason or another. The educational system in Canada is an abrasive system that's designed to miseducate systematically, not just Native Canadians, but Canadians in general. It's just that for one reason or another, non-Native Canadians seem to be able to put up with the nonsense better than First Nations people. Now, in terms of the actual failure of the system, now I've been to school systems where 100% of the incoming Indigenous children were identified as slow learners as they walked in the door. As soon as they found out they're Indians, well, then you're going to the slow learner program. And I've seen massive fraud in these slow learner programs executed with respect to First Nations people. I've seen programs where they don't even bother to pretend to do any kind of an assessment. They simply say, well, because they're Indians, they're slow learners, and they go to the slow learner program. And the slow learner programs, I've seen slow learner programs that consist of Native people playing snakes and ladders until they're tired of going to school and playing snakes and ladders all day. They can do that at home. Why would they go to the school system? So you get people being driven out of the system by sheer boredom, by sheer inattentiveness on the part of the administration and teaching staff to deliver. You see prejudice on the part of the educational staff. I was told to my face that the reason First Nations people weren't doing well in this particular school system that I was looking at was that Indians were stupider than everybody else. It's a kind of an attitude that it's not meant to foster any kind of an attempt to engage with issues. It's not an attempt to foster educational achievement on the part of First Nations people. It's an excuse to pretend to educate. I've always considered that not just fraudulent, but imagine what it must have been doing to generations of First Nations students who are being told that they're special needs students, that they're not capable of doing real academic work or of academic achievement. And it's not just the attitude that it fosters on the part of the students, because even what happens within the individual classroom, there's something that's known as the Pygmalion effect, that you live up to your teacher's expectations, but you also live down to them. So if everybody has conspired intellectually to say that these people are our kind of people, Indigenous people, are marginal human beings to begin with, and nobody has any expectations about what they're going to achieve intellectually, and if everybody is being rewarded for treating them as a class of student who will never really amount to much of anything, what have we created in terms of educational expectations on the part of the student?
We know that in general, undereducation is something that's very common amongst many people who come into contact with the legal system, Indigenous and non-Indigenous. But I think that there is a tendency to assume that education represents the same promise to everyone and that everyone has received the same quality of education. And I think it's a dangerous assumption to say that an education was always an available and attractive and even a possible alternative to people who have come into contact with the legal system. And we know this because there are decades of research, mainly in the area of critical pedagogy, really has highlighted the very different schooling experiences that non-dominant groups receive versus dominant groups. So what this means is that people who are incarcerated have likely had negative schooling experiences, and there is research that has documented this as well. Another thing that we know is that, and I already referred to this in the beginning, that is that high numbers of people who are incarcerated don't complete their high school education, and commonly they are referred to as dropouts, and this assumes that leaving school was the result of their own poor choices and the result of their own low commitment to school. And I think that if we can change the language to push out, then that would really open up spaces for looking at factors such as racism and other forms of exclusions that happen in school that contribute to student leavers, as opposed to always trying to reduce the issue to individual factors.
So in your article, Pipeline to Prison, published in Briar Patch magazine in September of 2012, you talked about punitive approaches in the education system and how this encourages Indigenous students to be perceived as dangerous and unruly, which is the beginning of problems for Native students in the school systems. Can you explain this concept?
I'd like to premise that my answer just by saying that I think that in our own Canadian context, we do need more research that specifically looks at differences in applications of discipline amongst different racial groups. There has been loads of research conducted in the United States that has focused on predominantly, like I said, young Black and Latino young men, as well as on American Indian students. And this research has demonstrated that racialized youth are disproportionately singled out for discipline. So what this suggests is that in Canada, we have our own work to do. So I think it would be unfair to state that we know that Aboriginal youth in schools are singled out for discipline in our Canadian context. I think that what we do know about Aboriginal youth who come into contact with the legal system and from studies on young offenders does point to a potential problem. We know that the majority of Aboriginal young offenders have been in trouble at school, and that that trouble often started at a very young age. So what I'm suggesting is that educators consider that given the overemphasis on discipline in school, and what I mean by that is that all too often in schools, the behavior management of students overrides all other school priorities. So given that, as well as the racist assumptions that are often made about Aboriginal students and who they are, that with the combination of the media that frames Aboriginal peoples as dangerous, that in schools, Aboriginal students may very well be perceived as in need of disciplinary interventions. And I think that this might explain, for example, why there is an overrepresentation of Aboriginal students who end up alternative schools and in special education programs.
So what are some common myths and popular ideas about why Indigenous youth are undereducated, and what do you think are some of the realities that lead to this?
I think that there are a few, but I will touch on which ones I perceive to be the most common myths and the ones that I hear the most often. I think that the first myth would be the racist assumption that Aboriginal students and their parents do not care about school, nor do they care about education. And this myth has far-reaching consequences for students. Another myth is that because Aboriginal youth may be living with the effects of colonization, for example, in poverty, the assumption that because of this, they are unable to learn, and the assumption that the school should focus mainly on providing basic necessities as opposed to providing them with rigorous, challenging and interesting curriculum. I think that within academic circles and within lay circles as well, a very popular explanation is the theory of cultural incommensurability. So put very simply, this theory is the idea that the home lives of Aboriginal youth are so different from the values that are taught at school, and it's so different from the culture of the school that youth just can't succeed. And I want to talk a little bit about why this theory is problematic, but I do want to say first that I'm not rejecting a meaningful integration of Aboriginal worldviews and Aboriginal cultures into schools. But what I am rejecting is the popular idea that if teachers could just insert some Aboriginal content into their curriculum, that Aboriginal students would automatically be successful. So insisting on this cultural theory really prevents educators from examining the racism that's embedded in all levels of the school system and the racism that Aboriginal youth experience on a daily basis in school. And this cultural theory, I think, is so popular because what it means is that educators in schools don't need to look inwards and they don't need to face the more uncomfortable work of anti-racism. The cultural theory really allows for the dominant population to keep on feeling really nice about themselves, and it continues to locate the problem within Aboriginal youth, within their parents and their home life.
You are listening to a conversation with Amanda Gebhard and Roland Christensen about the school-to-prison pipeline, how the Canadian school system contributes to the over-incarceration of Indigenous youth, and often places them on a trajectory to coming into conflict with the criminal legal system. Here on CKUT 90.3 FM on Prison Radio. Stay tuned. So what do you feel are some changes in the relationship between Indigenous and schooling that could improve the situation of the school-to-prison pipeline?
Well, I would be very hesitant to say that there's any easy, simple solution, but I think that what would mainly improve the situation would be moving away from deficit based assumptions and the focus on individualizing imperatives that continue to blame Indigenous youth. So moving from that to the examination of factors that are more uncomfortable and factors that would force non-Aboriginal peoples to insert themselves into the story of under-education and over-incarceration.
The question that I would ask is, would I really expect that it would improve if they decided to do it better? One of the difficulties that I often encounter is the notion that somehow Native people should be expecting the mainstream culture to fairly represent and or teach their culture to them. Well, there are, 600 different national groups and First Nations people across Canada, 600 plus. And I can't really see how teachers that are coming out of a teacher education program anywhere in Canada are going to be able to dedicate a sufficient amount of their study to really become relevant to the local First Nations that they're likely to encounter. I think that's part of why we get this, when we examined the curricula within New Brunswick, that we got this Pollyanna cartoonist version of what Indian people were, because first of all, it already set well with the prejudices of the mainstream teachers that were supposed to be learning the curriculum. That's one thing. It avoided controversy. I mean, if somebody's going to, the textbook actually that we looked at actually pretended to deal with some of the issues of residential schools. Well, of course it didn't. It couldn't. It's not how mainstream Canada wants residential schools understood. And they wouldn't be prepared to be able to explain the subtleties of the difficulties involved to the textbook was for 7th, 8th, and 9th graders. So how are they going to really be able to deal with the questions that would naturally arise from 6th and 7th, 7th, 8th, and 9th graders who are really encountering this information for the first time? They're not really learning it from their parents. They're not. It's not an extension of our forms of life in any sense. So I think the teachers would have been very much over their head in presenting it. What I find problematic is that they instead create a Pollyanna view and then force that upon the students. The students really don't have the critical capacity to give the these kinds of issues the import that they should. Now, the other aspect of all of this, for me anyway, is whether or not they have any business doing it. I prefer not to have some high school teacher going from, like I say, a Pollyanna-type textbook, presuming to discuss this issue with a bunch of students, whether they're First Nations students or not.
And how is the school-to-prison pipeline in so-called Canada part of ongoing colonization or the ongoing colonial project?
Well, I think that the colonization continues to occur on a number of levels and on a number of different ways, but I think that one way that it continues to occur is through love justice.
The connection that I see, anyway, that one that I'm arguing for, I think this is all a general system of destruction of First Nations people. I mean, the prison system is not really there to rehabilitate First Nations people. The prison system is there to assimilate us again. The connection I see is in the concept of alienation, that if anything, the difference between mainstream Canadian civilizations and Indigenous civilizations was their civilizations were by definition alienated. It's not just that First Nations people and European settlers just didn't get along. It's that their forms of life are antithetical to one another. And what's being required by the educational system is that we discard our forms of life. We're supposed to leave that at the door. We can dress as Indians if you want, and you can go home for the weekend and pretend to be an Indian there. But when you enter our institutional structures, you will behave like one of us. Or you will suffer for it. It's a penalization by not assimilating to non-Aboriginal forms of life. The school system enforces that. Even for mainstream people, this is one aspect that's really important. Mainstream people have been doing this for such a long time that they actually believe that an alien form of life is the normal form of life. For First Nations people, that's never been normal. We continue to find that abrasive. We find it abrasive everywhere. We find it abrasive in a school system. And it's like putting a vase under pressure. Just take any old vase and throw it down onto the ground. It'll break. You know it's going to break, but you don't know how it's going to break. First Nations people can break in a whole bunch of ways. We can break by committing suicide. We can break by family violence. We can break by alcohol and drug abuse. We can break by school failure, and we do. Those are all, the pressure of the system is designed to get us to break. One of the ways that we break is by giving in. When we do that, they call that a success, and it's called assimilation, and that's the underlying focus of their the system that we're placed under. Now, any stressor, I mean, you're going to throw a vase onto the ground and break it. You can't tell beforehand how it's going to break. One of the ways in which we break is through the use of, for example, controlled substances, illegal substances, or substances that we're not supposed to have access to before a particular time, like alcohol. And that entire, it's the stressor. It is a stressor, and it's designed to make us break. But one of the ways in which it leads to an increase in pressure, see, one of the things that you can do to people is to say, look, if you don't perform the way that we want you to, we can avoid giving you a job. And when I was young, it was actually illegal for Indians to vote or to get a post-secondary education. or to leave the reserve without permission. Well, one of the ways in which you can be put under pressure at all times, even today, is to be arrested, to be put on trial. And that forces us into connection, contact with information that's not conducive to a long-term successful form of life. When we learn that one of the ways that we can avoid the stress of this particular world is by checking out of it entirely, and you can start very early with alcohol, but guess what? It works with other drugs as well, and that it becomes a career, supplying drugs to other other individuals. It's when everybody wants them, it's a potential growth industry for you to be engaged in that those kinds of activities. Now, one of the things that is just historically the case is that First Nations people think that the criminal justice system is about whether or not they're guilty, as opposed to what a lawyer would tell you, and that is whether or not they can prove that you're guilty according to the rules of evidence of the court system. So a lot of people getting, in the old days, used to go to jail simply because they said, well, I did it. And their lawyer, a desultory lawyer who wouldn't be really wanting to have to put any effort into it, would simply go along with that as opposed to saying, well, let's fight it out and see if whether or not they can prove that you did it. So you have this whole long-term connection of like I said at the outset, everybody knows people who've been to prison, who've been to jail, who've been arrested, who've gone through the entire system in various ways, who pay the fine, who more or less put up with it. And so it becomes normative, becomes usual. It certainly doesn't, it's not extraordinary in any sense whatsoever. The school system is applying this pressure. It's applying the pressure to assimilate. It pretends that it's helpful, or it's trying to be helpful. It isn't actually helpful. In that sense, the stated intentions of the people who are doing this are irrelevant to the results that they're producing. The results that they're producing is that they are trying to get people whose form of life, whatever it was, wasn't an alienated form of life. They're trying to get us to accept that we must live an alienated form of life. One of our ways out of that is something that's likely to get us incarcerated. Now, that's a pipeline. To say that it's specific to the prison system, well, yeah, in the sense that most of the things that we would do, that we end up doing as a result of the pressure that's applied to us, does involve at some level a system of criminal justice, or at least intervention in our lives. Yeah, it's a pipeline, but the pipeline is probably more aptly named the longstanding demand that we assimilate, that we drop our form of life and that we adopt somebody else's form of life. And it's our unwillingness to do that. Most people don't see it that way. They just know that the life that they're leading is it's so demanding that they have to find something else to do. They can't put up with it. Like I say, the real pressure is to get us to agree to give it up. But there's ways of resisting giving it up, and those include ways that are going to get us in trouble with the criminal justice system.
We see a movement across Canada and different communities to not put Indigenous youth or students or children into Canadian models of school. And so we could call this a reclamation or indigenized approach to school, unschooling, if you will, even. And I wonder if you think that this might help as a solution or a way to deal with the high incarceration rates of youth who do go through the mainstream school system.
Well, you can see small movements toward it. There are places in Akwesasne, for example. We try to run programs out of St. Thomas University for the Maliseets within the province here. So there are attempts at doing this. There are two difficulties with the success of these things. First of all, they run into the situation that I mentioned before. There's a real clash of consciences in First Nations communities between those who believe that the school system in some way has to be able to represent and reflect Indigenous ways. But that's seen in opposition to those who assert that if First Nations people, First Nations children, don't get the quality of education that the employers are going to expect will result from engagement with the provincial curricula, then these kids are simply not going to have the same opportunities job-wise or career-wise in the long run. So the problem has always been about how do you build a system that's sensitive to Aboriginal ways that also deal with the information that's considered basic, necessary, fundamental for operating in the mainstream at the same time. I mean, one can be a functionary, or one can function in one society, but really still continue to respect and follow their own traditions. That's not necessarily a conflict. One of the difficulties in trying to conceive of those, and this is why I'd say these instances where they're actually working toward that are relatively few in number, is that most First Nations groups don't actually sit down and work out what their forms of life are. I would consider it to be a better idea if there were native-run, native-sponsored educational experiences that we did more typically than simply what happens now, and that is the vast majority of our children are turned over to a system that dismisses it, dismisses us, considers us marginal, and still actually considers our assimilation as a fundamental feature of its operation.
Amanda Gebhard writes in the conclusion to her Briar Patch article, Pipeline to Prison, available for read on the Briar Patch Magazine website. The suggestion that schools place Indigenous students on a trajectory to prison is in many ways in direct conflict with democratic ideas of education, but an important part of redirecting the gaze from the colonized to the colonizer is examining what often goes unquestioned or is accepted as common sense. Although schools can be positive forces in the lives of many youth, the opposite holds true for many others. The over-incarceration of Indigenous people is not common sense. It is a violent colonial project that requires the cooperation and complicity of countless people. Unmaking the situation will require the same sustained and concerted effort. Learning how we are all invited to participate in the colonial project of Indigenous incarceration and then refusing to do so is one of the first steps in demolishing the pipeline to prison for Indigenous youth in Canada.
Welcome back to the Prison Radio Show here on CKUT 90.3 FM. That was a piece by Candace Cascanet about the school-to-prison pipeline for Indigenous youth in Canada, looking at how the education system contributes to high incarceration rates of First Nations youth, featuring the voices of Amanda Gebhard and Roland Christjohn. The music featured in this piece is by Cree musician Chris Dirksen with a song titled Home on Native Land. The time is presently 5:47 p.m. And again, you're listening to Prison Radio on CKUT, 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca on the internet. We'll be back in a moment. Friday, December 13th, Rock Against Racism Montreal is back at Catacombs to feed your soul and shred your ears for a good cause. Featuring live performances from Scarlet Beast, Montreal Hardcore Punks, Sex Face, The Name Says It All, Lung Butter, Way Beyond Riot Girl, and Doppelbanger, Hard Feelings from your favorite CKUT Venus Ladies. Plus a punk rock dance party until last call with DJ Dan Brunette from CKUT's The Witching Hour. And as usual, zine kiosks, smiley punks, and good times. That's Friday, December 13th at Catacombs, 1635 Saint Laurent. $6 to $10 sliding scale gets you in, and all the money goes to Solidarity Across Borders. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
To end today's show, we have a poem written by federal prisoner Nikki Kish and read out during Prisoners Justice Day in Vancouver last August.
In the spirit of raising our voices in solidarity with people inside whose voices have been silenced, I wanted to read a poem today that was written by a young woman who's in Ontario in prison. Her name is Nikki Kish. Nikki Kish is an activist, a poet, and a musician. She's also a prison rights activist. She founded an organization in Hamilton, Ontario that provides books to prisoners. And she's currently serving a life sentence for second-degree murder for a crime that she probably didn't commit. By all accounts, she was railroaded, both by the media and a Toronto police, who were determined to put her in prison for what they euphemistically referred to in the media as the panhandler murder. I won't provide a lot of details today because really I just wanted to have her words speak today, or to speak her words. I wish she were actually here to read this. At the same time, though, I wish she really never had to write this in the first place. This is a poem that she wrote after what she described as a truly horrible treatment by the Max Unit staff at Grand Valley Prison for Women in Kitchener, Ontario. And she posted it on her blog. It's called Dear Jailer. Dear Jailer, hello. I just wanted to say hello. You see me every day, but you never say hello. You've yelled at me before. You've touched my body before. You've written reports on me before, but you've never said hello. I bet we have a lot in common, that we're more alike than not. I wonder if you spoke to me, if you'd still want me to rot. Did you know that I have feelings? I bet you have them too. I bet you laugh at funny jokes and cry when you are blue. I have many feelings too, and I get hurt by what you do. But you don't know this, and I don't share. You hate me, and of you I'm scared. But I bet we have a lot in common. I bet if we had a cup of coffee together, we'd learn that we share interests, hopes, and fears. And we might wonder the same wonders, and we might come to talk about important things. We might come to argue, but some truths it could bring. For you might say that criminals all hurt one another, and I might admit I think it's the guards who are trouble. And then we may argue about who could be wrong, but we'd also agree on one point that's strong. It's only the labels that make us feel hate. On a personal level, you may think I'm okay. You may say, that girl's not your average crook. And I may respond, you're not as cruel as you look. And you'd still probably believe in walls, cuffs, and bars. But I'd still conclude that guards commit crimes by being guards. And that leaves us at odds, divided and angry, and forgetting that we come from the same human family. Jailer, I just wanted to say hello today and wonder what would happen if we let go of hate. Thank you.
And now for some announcements and news briefs. The holiday season is upon us, and some of you may be wondering what you can buy for your family or friends that won't break your pocketbook. We have a suggestion: the Certain Days Freedom for Political Prisoners calendar. This may be the gift that you are looking for. You can buy it online at certaindays.org. Or you can also buy copies at various locations in the Montreal area, including the Concordia Campus Co-op Bookstore. This news brief comes to us from CBC. It was posted on December 2nd, 2013. The title, Aboriginal Women, One-Third of All Female Prisoners, Report Federal Incarceration Rates for Aboriginal Women up 84% in the last 10 years. Aboriginal women make up nearly 34% of all female prisoners and are one of the fastest growing segments of the population in Canada's federal prisons, according to the annual report from Canada's Correctional Investigator. The report says rates of federal incarceration for Aboriginal women have increased nearly 84% in the last 10 years. It notes contributing factors such as the effects of residential schools and child welfare programs. Chantal Genier, Justice Manager for the Council of Yukon First Nations, says those factors only scratch the surface. Housing, poverty, dislocation in the sense of cultural identity, a disconnect. Frankly, these all lead to issues for the federal system to deal with, quote unquote, Genier said. Even within the prison system, First Nations women face greater challenges than their non-First Nations counterparts. They represent 75% of self-injury incidents. They are also disproportionately represented in segregation units and maximum security and receive far lower rates of conditional release than non-First Nation inmates. Catherine Alexander, with the Elizabeth Fry Society, says the increase in number of incarcerated women can affect whole communities. Quote, as soon as you separate someone from the community, you separate them from their supports. You separate them from gainful employment. You're separating them from housing. And when people are struggling with those things in the first place, all you're doing is creating a bigger divide, Alexander said. From Prison Legal News, Volume 24, Number 10, this was posted in October 2013. In Peru, Juan Navarro spent 36 years and 8 months in the harsh conditions of San Pedro Prison in Lima before being released in April 2013. His memory had faded due to dementia and suspected mental illness, and he had no recollection of his age, whether he had appeared before a judge or whether he was convicted. Prison and judicial officials don't know either. Navarro entered the prison system in 1976 after being accused of killing his mother. At some point, he was transferred to the San Pedro facility, but his file was left behind and destroyed in a fire, and there is no record that he was ever convicted. Regardless, according to Peruvian law, he should have been released long ago. This post was posted on the National Post website, news.nationalpost.com, published on Wednesday, December 4th, 2013. Gay prisoners who want to live together lose appeal to share housing is the title, and it comes from Prince Albert, Saskatchewan. A judge has dismissed an application by two inmates at a Saskatchewan prison who are in a relationship and who want to live together. Jean Richter and Leslie Sinobart argued the Correctional Service of Canada is violating their rights. The two men told the court they are in a, quote, long-standing relationship and want to live in the same house in the minimum security annex at the Federal Saskatchewan Penitentiary in Prince Albert. Court heard they are serving life for indeterminate sentences and were transferred from medium security to the minimum Riverbend facility in the spring. They were then assigned to live in different housing units. Prison officials denied a request by the couple that they be allowed to live under the same roof, stating the men get enough time during the day to see each other in common areas such as the gym or cultural center. They also said Sinobart needs to be in a separate home specifically for inmates with mental health issues. Prison policy states inmates cannot be in a house other than the one they've been assigned to. Guards discovered Richter in Sinobart's house in July, and he was convicted of a disciplinary offense. He was fined $5 for the unsanctioned visit. Court heard Sinobart, 62, has had 3 strokes in the past decade and has suffered the effects of mercury poisoning since he was a child. The court decision provided no details on Richer. The couple did not have a lawyer. Richer represented both himself and his partner in court. To read the full article, go to news.nationalpost.com. To find out what's coming up next on the Prison Radio Show and our other prisoner-related activities in the region, check out our blog at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com and click on the calendar section. If we are made aware of them, we will post them. You can also subscribe to our podcast. The next Prison Radio Show will air on Friday, December 27th between 11 a.m. and 12 p.m. If you have any questions on anything that you have heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved with the show, feel free to contact us at prison@ckut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are encouraged to participate. Folks can also leave a message on our listener comment line at 514-448-4041, extension 2547. If you are in prison, we encourage you to participate in the show in any way possible. Feel free to write us at The Prison Radio Show, or simply write PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, postal code H3A H3A2B4. 2B3, sorry. So again, the postal code is H3A2B3. Thank you for tuning in to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Noah, and Aaron was here hosting earlier, and we were your hosts for today. Please stay tuned. Upstage is up next.
There is this thing. Do you realize do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
In the aftermath of her American and European tours, Myriam Gendron is coming home to Montreal with a single show at Cabaret La Tulipe on Thursday, December 8th. Come discover why tasteful musicians like Kurt Weill, Will Oldham, Bill Callahan admire Gendron's songs and stage presence. Myriam will share the evening with the dazzling fingerpicking of the great Glenn Jones. Tickets are on sale online. Don't miss this one. A Heavy Trip and CKUT co-presentation.
C'était une jeune fille.
Hey, you.
Yes, you.
Thanks for listening to this station. We're a not-for-profit organization dedicated to our community and you, the listener. We're able to operate because of the funds raised by our communities, but that's often not enough. We're asking you for help, which you can do by contacting your federal member of parliament, call or write, and ask them to support the development of a community broadcasting fund and extend the local journalism initiative. Learn more at ncra.ca/help. And thanks for listening.
Join us on Thursday, December 15th at La Sotarena for a community concert featuring performances by Johnny Void and Ida Toninato, a duo of Joseph Sanicandro and Stefan Christoph presenting La Lumière du Soleil dans un semi-sous-sol, a trio, Esther Boldage, Nicolas de Cross, and Alessandro Garino, taking place December 15th, La Sotrena, 4848 Saint Laurent. Doors 8 p.m., music 9. Presale $12, $15 at the door. This show is co-presented by Everyday Ego, Howell Arts, and CKUT. See you there.
CKUT and Island Organics presents a Christmas fundraiser for Resilience Montreal. Featuring DJs Cristobal Urbina, DJ Killjoy, Talentino, and the premiere of Mandala Hi-Fi. With Boss Man, legendary dub poet Zibs, Cali, with special guest Spoon B, and DJ Picante. Mandala Hi-Fi, $20 at the door, $25 after 11. Sunday, December 18th, Timmy's Bar, 900 Ontario Street East. This is an official CKUT co-presentation.
Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. The show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. Professional student and community productions in and around Montreal, the island also known as Zhujiangui and Ganiagaha and Munayang in Anishinaabe, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah DeA, recording from home on Thursday, December 8th, 2022. On tonight's show, my guests. Award-winning jazz vocalist, actress, and teacher Renee Lee on her upcoming turn in Dark Divas, an homage to the legendary singers who inspired her, figures like Josephine Baker and Billie Holiday.
They set the platform for vocalists of my nature and the ones that preceded me and the ones that will come after me. They gave us the mantle to continue on, because none of the seven women that I describe in the Dark Divas of performance are similar in performance or lifestyle or just who they were as individuals. But they all had a message that laid the groundwork for vocalists or vocal musicians like myself to tread upon.
Meet two students at the National Theatre School who take us behind the scenes of a project they say is the most ambitious show this academic year, a theatrical spin on Ovid's Metamorphoses.
There was this really beautiful moment this week where, after a crazy, hectic week of installing everything for the show, I got to sit down and watch my classmates and friends create and make art. And I got, like, almost emotional watching this, because I was like, I am so proud.